Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Bottled in China. I'm your host, Emily Steckenborn, and this is the podcast where we discuss food, wine, beer, and climate change all the way from out here in Shanghai, China. Well, today's topic is quite important because it impacts everybody and even future generations. Today, we're going to be discussing climate change leadership. And now, who better to speak about this topic than with Adrian Bridge? He is the leader of Porto Protocol and the CEO of Taylor's Port. He was instrumental in expanding port markets in the US and in the UK, and also creating various programs that allow us to find solutions and work together as a global wine community to fight climate change. So we're not just talking about what that impacts in the wine industry, but how we all can find solution towards climate change and really work together as one industry. Today, we're also going to be looking into various ways to reduce water usage, CO2 emissions, and even ways that you yourself can get involved and become a hero in fighting climate change. All right, that and so much more. Before we get started, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Bottled in China. Send me some insights of what you want to listen to or any specific podcasts that you love to hear about. And you can also find us on Spotify, iTunes, and click 5 stars if you love this episode. Cheers. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Bottled in China. Today, Adrian Bridge, who is the leader of Porto Protocol and the CEO of Taylor Port, joins us today. And today we're going to be speaking about climate change leadership and what that looks like for the wine industry. Adrian, I'm going to do a quick little intro about you, and then you're going to have to introduce yourself as well. But for anybody listening, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. As I've mentioned, we met about, I want to say 2 years ago, and I was blown away by Taylor Ports. I had the chance to taste through your portfolio a little bit. But for everybody listening, Adrian joined the wine industry in 1994 after moving to Portugal. He was instrumental in expanding port in areas like UK and the US. And in 2008, you created a new style of port called Croft Pink, and you even launched a luxury hotel. And I'm just hearing that now you're doing the world of wine. You must be busy every day. So welcome to the episode, Adrian.
Emily, thank you very much indeed. Yes, it is busy all the time, but made slightly more complex, of course, with the current global situation. But you're right. You know, a lot's been changing here in Portugal, and a lot of opportunities have arisen. And you know, we're a fairly old family company. We go back to 1692, so we're 328 years operating as a port business. And in recent years, I've kind of expanded the business into certain areas, and as you say, into some new styles of port altogether. So for me, you know, my journey, if you like, in the wine industry, I guess probably started quite some time ago. It is important to mention to your listeners that I didn't actually grow up. So I've married into the business, although I first came here in 1982 and married later on in the 80s. But I was in the British Army, then an investment banker, and then more lately in the wine business for the last 26 years.
You know, I think that you've brought a lot of innovation into the port industry, and I'm actually quite excited about that. One of the things that you've done, as you've just mentioned, is luxury hotels, the world of wine. We're going to have to talk about that on another one. But, you know, today we're going to be discussing climate change leadership. So in 2019, you guys organized the Climate Change Leadership Solutions for the Wine Industry Conference. Can you tell our listeners what that conference was like and what was it really involved?
Well, the interesting about it is that the story really started probably 20 years or so before that. I mean, I became CEO back in 1998. And, you know, we as a company have always taken a fairly responsible attitude towards the Douro Valley, the region in which we operate. We work closely with our farmers. We try very hard to share best practice with them and to help them run their businesses more efficiently. And I think, you know, when you've been in the business a very long time, there's a sort of natural leadership position that you somehow gravitate towards. And we've spent a lot of time and money on research and development, and then, as I say, shared that with our farmers. And it kind of struck me, I suppose, about 3 years ago or so, 3 or 4 years ago, that we should probably start to share that with a wider audience. And there was a man called Pancho Campo came to me to ask, we'd be involved in sponsoring a conference, you know, talking about the problem of climate change. And I said, look, I'm not really interested in talking about the problem. I think many, many people kind of get the problem. The issue is the solution, because for all the people who understand the problem, what they want to do is to know what to do about it. And so, you know, from that really came this concept of the Porto Protocol. And the idea behind it is purely that if we can share best practice from around the world, then everybody can benefit. You know, I don't see that the climate is the basis on which we should be competing between companies. I think we all live in one world, in one planet. Wine has the distinct luxury of being produced all over the world. And broadly, you know, it's the same plant in just different climatic conditions, and lots of different people are dealing with different challenges and all their solutions. You know, we can share those, then we can all move together faster forward. And that's really where the kind of concept started from.
Right. A lot of the speakers that you've had Obama, Al Gore, so many influential leaders. What are one of the key concept or ideas that you've seen people walk away from the conference from, and that you didn't expect that they would have that movement within the conference?
But I think the challenge with climate and change is that it seems such a vast problem that there is no easy solution. No single government can do anything about it. No single community, no single company. And I think the importance of the approach we're taking, which is talking about solutions and actually sharing best practice, is the fact that people can suddenly realize that they can contribute, and that every contribution, no matter how small, will make a difference. So rather than feeling kind of helpless and frustrated by it, people can actually start doing something. And I think, you know, certainly from a business perspective, one of the challenges that companies face is that a lot of climate activity comes with targets. You say, you know, cut your carbon footprint 10%. And any sensible CEO would then say, okay, I think that's a good idea. You know, the first question they're going to is, what is my carbon footprint? You know, how is it possible for me to cut it? What will it cost me? And once all those questions are actually answered, then they might commit to actually do something. And that means that if you like, that commitment to a percentage becomes essentially a barrier to activity. What we're asking people to do is to just start doing something. You know, don't wait till tomorrow. Just start making a contribution, no matter how small. And there are solutions out there which you can get from the Porto Protocol page or from your colleagues, competitors, whoever. There are lots and lots of solutions that are available that you can just start immediately to implement. You don't have to reinvent the wheel, because there really isn't time to reinvent the wheel. So it's this call to immediate action without necessarily asking people to quantify it, just to start doing something, that I think has created a level of empowerment with people that they can actually make a difference. And all then it comes is a question of mathematics, because if everybody is making a small difference, that fairly quickly adds up to a lot of difference. If everybody's inspired to try new ways and then to share what they're doing and share their successes, then everyone becomes involved and we get this virtuous circle created. And that to me has been the most positive aspect of what we have been doing really since we launched in July of 2018 with President Obama as the keynote speaker at that event.
Absolutely fascinating. And it truly is an event, a global event that unites everybody. And as you've mentioned, there's a lot of winemaking groups that will look into solutions within their own areas, but this truly is one that unites everybody together. And it's so important, as you've mentioned, not to try to always find new solutions, but to work together and utilize what's available and the resources which are available to us. So I think that's so important. And I think you've really tied in everybody, because every year it's something that is so useful to winemakers, producers, and now even importers, distributors want to get involved as well. But I want to talk a little bit about what you were just mentioning, which is workable solutions. And that's one of the core missions as well of the Porto Protocol. So you know, here's a fact that I think it was Wine and Vines that actually gave us this number. So it takes about 6 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of wine. So as we know, a lot of water is used in the winery as well as within viticulture. But can you share with us some innovations or best practices that can be adopted by wineries to reduce their water usage?
Yeah, I mean, they can go from fairly advanced solutions to some fairly simple things. The key numbers that you're using are correct. And in fact, compared to many other industries, that is not particularly bad in the winery. A lot of water actually gets used in growing vines through irrigation of vines in parts of the world, which would use substantially more water than what you're quoting there. And in fact, if you look at, in South Africa, they've got a huge amount of experience from dealing with drought conditions because there was virtually no drain for 3 years. And the wineries in South Africa have a huge amount of experience on this, which they are able to share. And there's many case studies on the Porter Protocol website. But I think when you look at a winery itself, you know, if you take the very simple, quite often, you know, your whole winemaker or wine hand would be washing down an area with a hose and then, you know, goes to switch on at the tap, goes over the hose, does the wash down, walks back to the switch off the tap, en route, gets a call, is asked to speak to a colleague, do whatever, takes time to go back and switch the tap off. And all the time that water is running down the drain. Whereas, you know, the simplest thing you can do is put a grip on the end of it. They look like a sort of pistol, but they are basically a grip by which you grip it and the hose is running, you let go of it, the hose is switched off. So in other words, the hose is only working when somebody has it in their hand at the point of control. That avoids a huge amount of silly wastage of water. It costs, you know, it costs $80, $90 for one of those. So it's a really simple and cheap and effective way to just control absent-minded wastage of water as much as anything else. I think, though, that, you know, there has to then be further balances of how water is treated in the winery, because a lot of water that is used for the process of, say, washing out tanks can also be recovered and maybe used to wash floors. You probably wouldn't use recovered water for anything that might go in contact with wine, but you can certainly recycle. If you go to more expensive solutions, then what we have is systems, for example, where we capture the rainwater off the roof. So rainwater harvesting is a pretty good way of collecting one's own water, as indeed is the, you know, putting in place the wastewater treatment systems that can recycle that water and make sure that out of that water that's being used, nothing is being wasted. And in fact, even can go further to irrigate, as we do, some fruit trees. So it's really thinking about the start to finish on the water journey, because water is a commodity that is in short supply in many parts of the world. And as many of us are seeing, that even if we look at our statistics of how much rainfall we have in a year, we're discovering that a lot of it is falling in much shorter periods of time and therefore is running off into the, you know, wastewater streams or into rivers, creating erosion, creating a lot of other challenges. So water is one of the biggest challenges facing any agricultural business, but particularly in the wine business, it is a crucial necessity.
Mm-hmm. I've also been hearing a lot of wineries switching from washing, let's say, their oak with power washers and then switching on to steam and using steam as an alternative, and that being really useful for disinfecting and cleaning up wood barrels, which obviously takes a lot of water as well. But as you've mentioned, so many different solutions that I think people need to really look in and integrate within their winery, because as we continue making wine, it doesn't get easier year after year with rainfall. And it, as you've just mentioned, it's very interesting to see that rain is coming, but in shorter periods of time. So that really is interesting, is as you mentioned, how you capture that water and reuse it in your vineyard and within the cellars. Interesting.
And I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, you were talking about washing of barrels and use of steam. I mean, there are other ways to do that as well, that even after a basic rinse, I mean, the use of ozone is becoming increasingly important as a way of sterilizing. And I think actually in the post-COVID environment, we're going to see quite a lot of development in cleaning systems, because what we're finding with, you know, cleaning of bacteria is that a simple surface washing or surface wiping is not sufficient. And what you're seeing is good growth in, for example, fogging machines, which use of electrostatic water, and the fogging machine provides much, much smaller droplets, which therefore can get into clean to a much greater intensity, but use significantly less water. Ozone as a gas, you know, is incredibly good. You have to be careful how you use it, because there are hazards for any living creature with excessive use of ozone, but it can work. So there are technologies out there. They're not expensive technologies. And I think in this post-COVID world, we're going to see some of that, those new technologies really coming to the fore. And I think that's positive. And I think this goes really to this idea that, you know, whatever the wine industry might be doing, sometimes the solutions are outside the wine industry. So we've got to sort of stop thinking in a sort of silo of what we do in the wine industry, although we can share best practice within all of us in the wine industry. You know, why aren't we talking to the people in the table grape industry? Because they're growing vines. Okay, their product is a grape which is going to be eaten rather than turned into wine, but they're dealing with the same challenges. If you look at the tomato growers, the tomato vine has a similar plant characteristics, some of the similar challenges in terms of water usage and disease control that you have in vines. Again, there's a lot of industry out there that is dealing with those challenges. So avoiding thinking in silos and looking to solutions that come from other industries, I think, is crucially important to our development.
Certainly. Well, that's going to be a very interesting after COVID, how, as you've just mentioned, all these various cleaning tools that might actually come out of this and also will help our own industry as well. One of the things I want to talk about is climate change, because there is a lot of news and media that covers the negative impacts of climate change. And yet a lot of people actually have said that it's beneficial for cool climate wine regions like Canada or Germany. But, you know, when discussing with Canadian winemakers, a lot of them have said that this isn't helping them at all, and that in fact there's a lot more frost risk, there's a lot more issues when it comes to growing the grapes, also because they have a shorter growing season and it gets a lot hotter faster. So I wanted to know, you know, based on that, are there any wine regions that are benefiting from global warming? Is that something?
I think one of the issues of climate change is that we use a lot of interchangeable words. We talk about the fact that it is changing, we then talk about global warming. We tend to mix a number of things up in my mind. Certainly warmer conditions in further north, as we move, for example, whether it's up into Canada or up into the UK or whatever, conditions in those countries where they are now warmer, they are going to be better suited to growing grapes. That would be considered to be potentially positive for them. But the challenge of climate change nowadays is not just that we can measure this in absolute temperature. What we have to look at is climate change is mostly impacting us in terms of irregular weather patterns. So whether it is rainfall coming in shorter bursts, where we're having then to deal with erosion and flooding, whether it's extreme of heat that can, in the case of a vine, you can lose your crop in a week if you have a heat wave. And yet that'll never show up on the annual average statistics of weather. So it's the extremities of weather change that is the biggest issue that we face. And whereas there may be minor benefits in certain countries where they have become warmer, we have to accept that that is offset by regions that have traditionally grown grapes that may well become too hot and indeed maybe heading towards becoming deserts. So again, we have to look at the whole here from the global perspective. And yes, there will be some advantages for some, but normally that is at the cost of a lot of other regions. And we've seen that, you know, we've seen that in migration patterns. If you look at what's happened in Central America, much of which has stimulated people to move north into the United States because they're looking to, they can no longer grow a crop in their small holding in Central America, and they're looking for somewhere to live. You know, that has extreme negative consequences because it brings into play, you know, with immigration, it brings into play a number of other geopolitical challenges. So I think we've got to take a very open view and remember that for anyone who's benefiting from it, there's probably a lot more people who are losing out. And that is probably in the longer term, not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And how's everything shaping out for Portugal and, of course, specifically for Taylor's Port? How is that impacting your winemaking and your viticulture?
Well, you know, for us, we are having to deal with these sudden changes of climates. I mean, if you look at this year, for example, we've had a much warmer season than normal. the vines came into life probably 2 weeks earlier than we would normally have. That meant that, and we had a very fairly dry winter, so we've ended up having a lot of rain during the vegetative growth stage, which puts you at disease risk. Obviously, you've then got to make the treatments for that, which is probably negative for the environment if we're having to do more treatments to cope with this change in the viticultural cycle. Right now, our challenge is hail and thunderstorms. In the last decade, we've probably had hail damage at least 8 times in the last decade. So 8 years out of 10, we've had hail damage. That never used to happen. And it's something that is extremely difficult to protect against. And we've been running a program here along with a number of other wineries in order to work with an alert system to figure out when those conditions for hail are going to happen. And then using cloud seeding. The technology is relatively inexpensive, but you can actually seed the clouds to cause the precipitation before it comes down as hail. You need a cooperation across the region. You need the involvement of government entities. You need the financial power of individual companies. What you'd mostly need is a joined up vision from everybody that it is to everybody's benefit of working together. And I think that brings us round to the concept of what the Porto Protocol is about, and that is the ability to try to encourage people to work together towards a bigger common goal rather than feeling that they should, you know, sit in isolation and try to compete on all grounds. Let's not compete on climate. Let's share best practice globally.
Certainly. Now, one of the things as well, I know we were talking about some financial decision makings that actually might benefit the winery as well as be sustainable practices, but I want to talk a bit more about that. Can you share some insights regarding some cost reducing techniques that either yourselves at Taylor's use or wineries that joined the Porto Protocol that have shared those practices that are, once again, financially great decisions as well as being sustainable in their processing?
Yeah, I think the point about this is one can actually spend a vast amount of money, and often the sensation that one's got to spend a lot of money to make change is what puts people off doing something. You know, the simplest argument I have is when people say, "No, you can't help because it's too expensive." I tend to ask them, "Well, if you switched off all the lights in your house that you weren't using, in rooms that you weren't in, you would be a little bit more careful about that. What would your electricity bill be at the end of the month? Would it be higher or lower?" And of course, everyone understands automatically that it would be lower. And that's the same for any business. And so, you know, the easy, really easy steps is to stop waste. And it doesn't cost you money to stop waste and makes an immediate return. But I think, you know, if you look at other, and let's just stay with power as an example, you know, the solar technology now is so extensive around the world, the cost of putting in solar panels is relatively low. And we, in fact, generate nearly 75% of our energy off solar panels, which we stick on the top of our winery roofs, pretty good big roofs, easy things to put solar panels on. But, you know, a lot of people might be put off by that because the payback is typically, in the case of the first ones we put in, the payback was about 15 years. More recently, it's dropped to below 10. But for a wine company where we plant vines with an economic life of 40 years, you know, I'm not particularly frightened about something that's going to cost 10 years payback because, you know, yes, there's a cost now, but there's going to be a lot of free energy down the road. So it's that ability to take the long-term thinking, which I think is so important. And that's why the wine industry itself can be so good, because if you look at what we as an industry represent, you know, we often are farming parts of the world where no other crops will grow. Vines happen to be quite suited to extreme conditions. And, you know, the Douro Valley is an example where if you didn't have vines, you've really only got olive trees, not much else will grow up there. So we're looking after remote regions. We're often doing so within family structures. And this brings me to the sort of point of time frame. You know, it's much easier to make an investment that has a longer term payback if you're thinking about the fact that your children or grandchildren will benefit from it. And indeed, in the wine industry, most of us who are making great wine are making it off vines that were planted by our parents or grandparents. So we are direct beneficiaries of people who have gone before us, and we have the same responsibility of leaving that for future generations. But I also think the wine industry is the only branded agricultural industry in the world. It's the only product that you can go anywhere in the world, open a bottle, and you can look at the label and you know exactly where it came from, you know exactly who made it. And if you want to phone them up, they'll probably be able to tell you exactly which piece of the land it was actually grown on. And you can't say that of any other product. So this uniqueness of the wine industry and this ability, actually, the wine industry to directly communicate with the end consumer makes it a very powerful vehicle for change, partly because it has this very long-term vision. And I think that's hugely positive. And I think that's why the wine industry can really take a strong leadership position within the agricultural industry.
Certainly. I think, as you've just mentioned, I believe actually it was Jamie Good at the Porto Protocol said that the wine industry is the canary in the coal mine, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that what you've just mentioned definitely does resonate. And Ayodhya, we're almost out of time, but before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, where can my listeners learn more or even become a member of the Porto Protocol? And how can somebody commit by signing a letter of principles? Can you give us a little bit more information?
Yeah, so what the idea of the Porto Protocol is that anyone can sign up. If you're a company, we basically ask that you sign up. It doesn't cost money, although at the moment it's financially being supported just by Taylor's Port, but we are obviously getting donations from many other companies, and many of the people who do sign up donate, and that is important. But there isn't a direct cost. The commitment that you're making is to share things that you're doing. So you can't come in and just learn from everybody else without sharing. So the idea is you sign up, you commit to share, and essentially you're going to commit to learn at the same time. And if you're an individual that's listening, we have a thing called Heroes. And the Porto Protocol Heroes are the people who might not be winery owners, may simply be wine lovers, but these are any individual who wants to become a hero becomes essentially an additional voice, because it's only when everybody is asking for change that things really will change. In a company, you know, you can't just expect the CEO to wake up one day and come up with some bright idea that things are going to change. He's going to listen to his fellow members of the company, his employees, his staff, his fellow board directors, his shareholders, whatever. And if everybody is asking for change, then change will happen. So coming onto the Porto Protocol as a hero, you're making a commitment to make a voice louder and to ask for change in your company, in your business, in your community. And I think when everybody does that, that's when things really start to happen. So all change starts from small seeds, if you like, but from that we can grow. And I think if we can hold the vision of the fact that every small contribution will in the end make a big difference, then anybody who is listening, please, you know, sign up to the Porto Protocol, start to share what you're doing, start to take those first steps. You'll find it very rewarding, because there's nothing like success to make you feel you want to do more. And if you don't have the capacity to lead a company and you're just talking about your own life, well, you yourselves individually can make a difference just by using less water, electricity, producing less waste. You will be contributing, and every small bit makes a difference.
Certainly. Adrian, thank you so much for all the insight, for the energy that you bring towards change, and all the initiatives that you're running at Taylor's Port, because there's so much that you guys are doing to really create a community and a global community that is in the wine industry. So thank you so much. And for everybody listening, we're going to put all the information on how to sign up in the show notes. So you can also just click on that and learn more about the Porto Protocol, Taylor's Port, and everything that we discussed here today. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you very much, Emily, and thank you for all your listeners. And as you say, this is global. We have actually over nearly 500 wine companies around the world already signed up, already committing to make a difference. So, you know, I'm sure that all of it will count, and our children and grandchildren will thank us for this.
Certainly. Thank you so much for your time.
Emily, thank you very much indeed. Take care.